All right, welcome back to Computer Science 50. This is the end of week 9. We've got a great lecture for you here today. We're finally going to reveal how Shuttle Boy works. We're going to talk a little bit about the scavenger hunt that's in progress. I am advertising today, I'm told, for the Asian American Brotherhood. So this is the front of the shirt, if you'd like to soak this in. I think it says, Gail? What does it say? The overeager section guy? And then the back, apparently. So, you know, this wasn't my intention to become like your personal billboard up here. So maybe we'll stop after this week. But let's see, no announcements today. Problem set 7, I'm sure, is in progress. What we're going to look at in just a bit is how I implemented something like this and as it relates to problem set 8, in which you'll be doing a Google type mashup. Unfortunately, even though I think we demoed this in like week 0 of the course and everyone was oohed and aahed by the moving dots that represented the shuttle buses, apparently Shuttle Services has tweaked their map since September. So you might see that there are no shuttle buses in this wonderful implementation of Shuttle Boy. But if you zoom out, they're currently in downtown Boston, the shuttles. It's not a total loss, because if you zoom out far enough, then it's actually pretty accurate. But I will go in and redress that. But we can still use it for the sake of conversation today, because what I've done with this sort of relatively simple idea of showing dots on the screen, similarly will you do this kind of thing for problem set 8. And it's really not all that hard. And frankly, it's a lot of fun that so much of this stuff is so easily accessible on the internet today. So we'll also end today, I think, by taking a look in more detail on how the internet works by way of that fun Swedish film that we gave you a teaser for a week or so ago. So you may recall from the previous forensics problem set, you recovered a whole bunch of photos, and a bunch of you have been wonderfully showing up at Jansu's dorm door to take photographs of her, Cato as well. Professor Henry Leitner, who had no idea he was part of this problem set, he was the one who was sliding into like second base. I took that photo off the web, forgot to mention to him that he might have folks showing up at his door for a couple of weeks, but he's been delighted to meet you all. He teaches Computer Science 1 at the college. So there's hopefully some familiar, some unfamiliar photos. I'm told that this is a particular challenge at the moment, so good luck with that one. Some of them we took just because it amused me and my friend. I had never noticed that the stadium mentioned the joy of manly contest. And we couldn't help but include that among the photos. This one, I'm told, is similarly hard, if not beautifully artistic. Credit, of course, to my friend. And then some of these you should see around campus, some more easily found than others, but hopefully you will take advantage of a stroll around campus perhaps this weekend to find some of these remaining photos. And if nothing else, even if you have no interest in doing the scavenger hunt, if 300 of you could please show up at Professor Henry Leitner's door at 51 Brattle Street in Harvard Square, I'd be much obliged. It would go over great, I think. So, with that said, let's see where we're at. So what I thought would actually be fun to look at, so that you actually don't do everything we tell you to do just because we're telling you to do it, I thought I'd try to give you a compelling example of why, for instance, you have to follow some of the example code we've been given you. So if you've dived into problem set 7, you might have copied and pasted a function called MySQL real escape string, which is a wonderful example in bad style, given that the function name is annoyingly long to type. But this function does actually have some utility. So this is not among your slides. I pulled this from another course that I teach at the Extension School, for which I'm actually looking for teaching fellows per our homepage. So check that out if you like this stuff. But this is a login form from this other course's website, very oddly similar in structure. I kind of copied and pasted myself. But what I thought I'd do is give you an example of why you've been jumping through some of these hoops. So here is a blank login form in which you would type your username and password. And just like CS50's website, we have a MySQL database in the back end that actually contains information on the students in that course, and usernames and passwords and stuff like that. Well, if you don't have a good understanding of how this stuff underneath the hood works, and you don't have an understanding of what's going on with HTTP and SQL, it's very easy to screw yourself over when you put your intellectual property out there on the web or your hard work because you put yourself at risk to anyone out there, people you don't even know, messing with you, deleting your data, corrupting your data. And you can do it by making very simple mistakes. So the example I thought I'd give you is this. Suppose that some malicious user wanted to try to hack into your web server, on which there might be way more important stuff than just this particular page. Imagine important data there. Well, suppose that in the back end, what's actually happening when you submit this login form is that this query here, which I've just pasted from the PHP code, is what's actually executed. So we have a MySQL query passing it a string that's of the form select UID, user ID, from the users table, where their username equals something and the password equals something. And then notice what I'm doing. Because I'm using sprintf, just like in C, I'm passing in two variables, the username and password. But notice that I'm passing in directly to this function whatever it is the user typed in. So you could type foobarbaz, and that's what I'm going to pass as the first or second argument to this function. Now, that in and of itself is not such a bad thing. We did this a whole bunch in C. But the problem is you're now passing that string to a database, to the MySQL database, in the form of this SQL query, this select query. So the problem is, what if your user kind of suspects you're using MySQL and is trying to mess with you? And what if they type in, instead of a username or password, they actually type in a SQL query, like delete from table name or something, drop table, which would just delete a table altogether. In other words, what if they try to inject SQL just because they think you might be a bit of an amateur and you haven't actually protected against this kind of attack? Well, it's not that hard to exploit. So this second slide here shows what a malicious user might go ahead and type in. So if I want to just be nasty, I can go ahead and type in, say, a normal username, but then a password of, for instance, 12345, single quote, or single quote 1 equals, quote unquote 1 equals single quote 1. So this is malformed, notice. But what this is probably assuming is that this string is going to get pasted in between two single quotes, thereby completing this puzzle. So in fact, if we look now at the query that I'm executing as before, notice what's going to happen here. Because I'm using sprintf and I've put on around my %s, this single quote and this single quote, well, those are essentially going to complete this string, just to be dramatic there. So now it will appear well-formed as soon as it's pasted into that select statement. But so what do you think it means, though, if you execute a SQL query that says select UID from users where username equals %s and password equals %s, if what ultimately gets executed is select UID from users where username equals jharvard and password equals 12345 or 1 equals 1. Well, what's that expression always going to evaluate to? True, right? It's sort of this vacuous truth. Of course, 1 equals 1. But because you've been able to sort of nastily append it to the Boolean expression that is the where clause in the statement, what you're inducing is a behavior on the database server, which is to just give you back a UID, because that phrase will always be true. And the effect of this then is what in the context of a login page? You get logged right in, right? Because your username's going to be jharvard, even if you're not even John Harvard, but it doesn't matter what your password was, because you told the database, well, maybe my password's 1234, or maybe 1 equals 1. Well, one of those is always going to be true, and so jharvard's account has now been compromised. So there is, in fact, this very annoyingly long name that's passed in. This, to be clear, is exactly what gets executed in this case. And notice, this code doesn't look bad, right? At first glance, this actually looks pretty nice. It's nicely indented. It's not sloppy. So you might actually think the programmers put some thought into this, but it's not that hard to end up creating this in red. Nasty expression. Well, the simple fix, and fortunately it is this simple, is to escape. Similar in spirit to what we've done in C with backslashes on occasion, but to escape any user input that you pass to a database. And in general, this is just significantly good practice. Never trust the user, whether it's a C program, whether it's a web-based program, because all it takes is one person to delete all of your data or to completely crash or exploit your server, and it's generally not that hard. In fact, many of the compromises that we've mentioned earlier in the semester when it comes to security and viruses and worms, well, often it boils down to people not checking the length of their buffers or, more generally, just not checking what the users type in. So your takeaway for the problem set is just do this because it's good practice, but appreciate, especially come final projects, that it actually does matter, because it's very easy to expose yourself to people with too much free time. And actually, that's a wonderful segue to the big board. So congratulations to Drew, who has turned his $10,000 on Monday into $44 million as of Wednesday. It's not that the big board has been exploited per se. It's just that we, lacking in free time, have just not tried to work around every possible sort of manipulation one can make of our little market system here. So we are using, even though Yahoo does offer real-time quotes here, we, like for you in the problem set, went ahead and used the last trade price, which is roughly 15 minutes delayed. So a student, and credit to Drew, in fact, he's applied to be a teaching fellow, I noticed, so I think he's in good shape so far. So this is quite the compliment. But you can effectively see into the future, right? If you so much as have like MSNBC on or Bloomberg or any, you know, E-Trade account, you can see what stocks have just gone up, but we're sort of the course 15 minutes behind the rest of the world, so you buy that and then you sell it when it goes down, and especially in the volatility of the past few weeks, apparently Drew has completely kicked everyone else's ass thus far. I was actually feeling pretty good. Like Tuesday morning, Malin was up at like $10,998. I'm like, yeah, 10%. And now it's just, it's sad. But we'll counterbalance this. So credit to, say, Matthew and Ernest and Glenn, who have just invested their money and are letting it sit there. And perhaps they will to recoup some of those losses as well. So feel free to have fun with that. That's part of the exercise. And you'll see on the bulletin board that some of our more comfortable students perhaps are enjoying figuring out the ways in which they can make fake money off of the course. So where we left off on Monday was introducing JavaScript and introducing this notion of object-oriented programming and doing this in the context of a web page, because web pages actually lend themselves nicely to this discussion of objects and hierarchy, because a web page is exactly that. It's this nested structure that starts with an HTML tag that then has a head and then a body tag, and then indented, usually beneath that, is a very clear nesting of structures. So you can really think of a web page as kind of a tree, a family tree, where the HTML element is sort of the ancestor of all ancestors, and beneath that are all of these children and descendant elements. Well, we can depict this by way of this simple example. So here is among the simplest web pages you can write that is valid XHTML, valid in that every tag that's opened is, white lie already. The smallest valid web page you can make. We have to close that tag. So we have now every tag that's opened is closed. Every attribute that's in there is quoted with a pair of single quotes or double quotes. And we also have our doc type at the top. And the doc type is just a snippet of code that tells the browser, hey, browser, this is the language called XHTML version 1.0. And we're using the transitional version of it. For this course, this is one of those copy-paste jobs. It doesn't really matter if you memorize it. Frankly, all these years later, I still can't type that from memory. But I just copy-pasted from previous work. But you need it in order for your code to be considered valid. Well, what is this really being represented as in memory? Well, your browser, upon receiving this very simple page, is probably reading it top to bottom, left to right, and when it encounters a bold tag, a B tag, it turns on the bold-facing feature, and everything it continues to print is going to be in bold. And as soon as it sees open bracket slash B to close the bold-facing, it's going to stop doing that. But in memory, it's going to be representing this page probably with some kind of structure. And so what we have here is a depiction of what we call DOM, the document object model. And it's sort of a very straightforward translation of what looks like a nice hierarchy in text. This slide, I guess we should fix this to be consistent. So this slide is the same as the previous, but I've simply added this graphical depiction of it. So notice that on the top of it, we have a generic notion of the document, which gives us the ability to talk about descendants. The so-called root element is required to be the HTML element. And then as you can tell from the nesting, or just by thinking through the page logically, you have one child called head and one child called body. And beneath those things, do you have further hierarchy? So this is only to say, that we can now finally bring into play our discussion from a couple weeks ago of trees, data structures. If you're writing the next version of Chrome or Firefox or Internet Explorer, and you need to model a web page in RAM, odds are you're going to use a tree structure like this, whether you're using pointers or some other mechanism, depending on the language you're using. Now, this is relevant and useful because now that web pages are getting fancier and more dynamic, thanks to a technology called AJAX, it's important to sort of understand how this thing is represented in memory, a web page, because with AJAX, and specifically with JavaScript, can you manipulate this tree after it's been built up in memory? So back in the day, when you visited a website and you pulled up the HTML and it got rendered, that was sort of it. Like, there was no changing the page, there was no updating content within the page. If you wanted to update that page, you went ahead and hit refresh, or you went to another URL altogether. But these days, most of you guys use Gmail. Gmail has this wonderfully interactive and seamless interface. There's rarely a huge page refresh. Facebook has gotten even better at this. When you're browsing photos, you get that temporary little progress bar, but you don't reload the whole darn page. Just some of the photos now get loaded into memory off of the web. So AJAX, asynchronous JavaScript and XML, is what it used to stand for. Now it's evolved into different flavors. Simply refers to that kind of technology where you pull up a web page once and then you grab additional content sort of on demand without reloading the whole page. And what we're getting now is this convergence of web-based software and client-side software, which has always been pretty interactive. When you're using Microsoft Word and you choose some menu option, rarely does your whole window sort of redraw itself. Just one part of the window changes. And that's exactly what's happening on the web. And this is all thanks to recent browsers implementing a special kind of object. And this object is called the XML HTTP request object. And this is just someone's sort of standardization of what it means to represent an HTTP request in memory. And what this allows a web page to do specifically is not only to be loaded into memory and be rendered the first time, but the web page itself can make subsequent HTTP queries of the web server that aren't even initiated by the user. It's the web page that's actually requesting another URL, another URL. So in fact, in the Shuttleboy example, when these dots are actually moving, notice that they move not terribly smoothly. It's not perfectly in real time, but this dot looks like it's moving, unless the bus is now, there we go. So he's kind of driving off the sidewalk. That's just a little imprecision error on my part, but it's moving bit by bit. And I think the delay I set was to be like half a second, maybe 1 second, which is to say that this web page is making a new HTTP query every half second or every second. And we can actually see that, right? I've preached the utility of Firefox because of its plugins. Well, we can see, I didn't do anything. Notice the progress bar is getting sort of shorter and shorter because more and more HTTP requests are going across the wire. And it looks like, yeah, once per second, because notice the timestamp is going from 36 to 37, 38, and so forth. So what do you think this page is downloading? It doesn't appear to be downloading the whole new map. So what is getting downloaded? What's that? Yeah, exactly. It's just the position of the bus. What the way I wrote the code, as we'll see in a little while, is just that every second I grab the current GPS coordinates of each of the shuttle buses that is on campus, and then all I have to do on the web page is find the corresponding red icon and move that thing to the new GPS coordinates. And that's why you get these little skips, because I, you know, rather than trying to make a perfectly smooth transition, I just update the coordinate. But I do it frequently enough that it kind of looks like a nice animation. Yeah. Ah, so that's a good question. What if the bus moves off the screen? Suppose the bus sort of, doesn't stay on the road but goes back up and then maybe goes up Mount Vernon Street up there to the north. Well, so in that case, it depends on how you implement the code. And this will actually be a design decision for you in problem set 8. I believe the way I've done it is I still update the coordinates. I tell Google's API, application programming interface, where the shuttle bus is, but I leave it to their API to figure out if they need to show the red icon or just not bother. So that's something I can sort of punt to them and deal with it. So, and notice actually, and if you've all probably used Google Maps before, notice that if you do this fast enough, you do see a bit of a flicker, right? Everything becomes gray temporarily, at least if I do this fast enough. Well, why is that happening? Right, you do see a bit of a flicker, not the whole page, it's contained within the box, within the map itself, but why that flicker? What's going on? Yes, well, so it's not so much, it is redrawing it, but it's going and getting those blocks. So Google has probably, and you can figure this out empirically, modeled a map, like almost all of these sites, with a bunch of cells, like little squares. And so what's happening is if I click and drag so fast that the browser hasn't yet gotten around to downloading the next few tiles up to the north, well, very quickly does Google's API, does this web page's JavaScript, have to make a really quick HTTP call asking for some more GIFs or some more JPEGs, those then get returned, not in the form of a whole new web page, just the JPEGs come back down the wire, and then the JavaScript code that Google has written, presumably, takes those JPEGs and actually inserts them into the right coordinates in the page. Yeah. Correct. Good question. To summarize for camera, so MapQuest and even Yahoo Maps back in the day, you would often click up, down, left, right, and then it would redraw the whole page to show you a new tile. Why was that the case? It was largely because the technology wasn't yet there. So it's only fairly recent browsers, Internet Explorer 6 and Firefox, I think, 2, that have begun to support AJAX, and more specifically this thing called an XML HTTP request object, which is to say you just couldn't support it then. But frankly, part of this just came down to the innovation of companies like Google. There probably was a time where anyone could have been doing this, but it was, frankly, Google who sort of hopped on that wave the quickest and totally blew out of the water MapQuest and Yahoo when they first deployed just because of this much nicer interface. Good question. Others? Yeah. Okay, so why do we see this flicker? It doesn't really so much have to do with the screen refresh rate. It just takes a non-zero amount of time to download some number of bytes or kilobytes. So you see that gray blocks, you see that flicker because it takes time over the internet for that piece of data to be downloaded. So actually, just for the sake of discussion, if you were the engineer implementing this and you wanted, just because you're so anal, to get rid of this flicker, at least with high probability, what are some techniques you could use to minimize or just get rid of that kind of brief flicker? Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a perfect word to use for it. You could, very simply, if not intuitively, just prefetch some data. So if the user's already looking at this set of tiles, you know, probably with non-zero probability, are they going to want to look up, down, left, or right within the next few seconds? So why not go ahead and prefetch the tiles up here, the ones down here, and the ones down here? Because if the user actually does that, and you've, you know, bet on the right user's behavior, voila, they're going to have a nice seamless interface because you have taken it upon yourself to prefetch the data. And that principle is actually really common. Even in the world of compilers and in execution of software, there's a lot of interesting performance enhancements you can make by trying to guess or make educated guesses as to what a program even is going to do next so that the right bits are sort of waiting there for the CPU. But again, one of the themes in this course has always been trade-offs. Nothing's for free. So what is the downside or the cost of prefetching, would you say? And maybe why is Google not doing it, at least to large extent here. Sorry? So more memory? What type of memory? RAM. Okay, so that's one thing, right? It's going to fill the client's memory with more bits that might not ever get used, and that seems potentially wasteful. What else? Yeah. So bandwidth is probably the big kicker. So bandwidth is not free. When you're running a relatively small site, you know, you might pay $19.95 a month for your hosting, maybe even $100 a month, and you get, you know, several gigabytes or even terabytes of storage space and bandwidth. I mean, every single byte change that Google makes to its homepage, you have to magnify by, you know, 500 million requests per day, and that's not free. And the pennies or the fractions of pennies certainly add up. So a very reasonable business trade-off might be, yes, it might make a better user experience, but is it really worth $1 million a month to improve what's already a pretty decent map implementation? So money is also one of the trade-offs you'll find, certainly if you apply these same ideas in the real world. Yeah. Yes, so that's a really good question and point. So by using AJAX, do you increase the load on your server? Absolutely. So I am I don't think FAS has noticed, but if we all pulled up Shuttleboy right now, we would be hitting FAS's people.fas web server 300 times per second, which a decent web server should be able to handle, but mine is not the only account on FAS's systems. Presumably there's other people using the web. So incidentally, the fact that it says shuttleboy.com is just a bit of trickery. It's really being hosted out of my FAS account, but I just thought it'd be nice to say shuttleboy.com, so it's using an HTML frame, if you're familiar. But what's really going on here is that this is, let's see, if I go people.fas.harvard.edu/tildemalinsb, I think is where it lives. That's really where it lives. So where we really are is right here. So is our use of AJAX, is my use of AJAX hitting FAS's server more? Yeah, it's hitting it one time per second. And in fact, this has bitten even us, the course, a couple of times over the semester. One of the projects we've been working on, thanks to Vivek and Lin Feng, has been to automate the whiteboard in the Science Center. So one of our goals for next year is to collect more data on how long people are being helped at office hours so that the teaching fellows and I can sort of optimize our own workflow. And so some of you, if you've gone to office hours recently, have signed into a web page that allows you to, that allows you to put your name and a question on a web page instead of the whiteboard. And then what the staff have at their own website is something like this. Actually, I'll keep the names most. Okay, Christopher. So what we have is a web page that updates itself every second or every 5 seconds so that we see exactly whose hand is up at office hours. The problem is I made the mistake of, one, querying Google servers every time the page refreshed so that we could get the latest office hours data, because you've seen, of course, the course uses Google calendars, and we were hammering the hell out of our own web server to the point of slowing it to a crawl, and this is why we yanked the office hours tool for a couple days until I could go back with the guys and improve our own code. It was just a mistake on our part. It was the right idea, but just poorly implemented by me, primarily. So absolutely, it comes at a cost, and it's very simple for, clearly, a user who lives on your server to make a design decision or make a mistake that then brings down your whole server effectively because they're causing users to hit it so hard. So more trade-offs still. Other questions? All right, so what happens then? What's the flow? Just to sort of set the framework here, and because this is exactly what's going to be going on underneath the hood come problem set 8 when you're using Google's own Google Maps API. So this picture is perhaps a bit more complicated than it needs to be. This is simply to tell the following story. So if on the left-hand side we have something representing the client, and on the right-hand side we have something representing the server, say google.com, what happens is the following set of steps. You have some user interface on the client side, like the web page. So the shuttleboy.com web page that has the Google map embedded. What happens every second is that a JavaScript function is called. So that's step one. That JavaScript function specifically uses this new thing called an XML HTTP request object. It bundles up inside of it a bunch of HTTP parameters, like what shuttle stop do you want, what destination do you want, those kinds of things, arguments. It then makes an HTTP request unbeknownst to the user from client to server, and that request obviously hits the server. The server, meanwhile, might talk to its own database, called here data stores. Not in the case of Shuttleboy, but in the case of problem set 8, you will, on the server side, be talking to a database. It does some stuff, comes up with an answer, comes up with some data or a new piece of the map, for instance. And so step 4 is to return that to the user. And then step 5, which is the last on the client side, is to just take that data, much like Shuttleboy does, and somehow integrate it into the page by way of a couple of JavaScript calls. And none of this is all that hard, thanks to the existence of public API and standardization. So just to give you a sense of what functions you will have access to in problem set 8, or at least the API you'll be using is itself using, is very simple things. So if you've got this object called an XML HTTP request object, think of it like it's the wrong lesson to take away. Think of it kind of like a library. Inside of this object is a whole bunch of functions you have access to. And in the world of object-oriented programming, we start calling functions methods. So that's the piece of jargon here. So associated with this XML HTTP object is a function like, is a method like open and send and abort and just some variations of those same things. Because that's all this thing does in life, is it allows you to open connections to another server, send a request, and get back a response. So there are, in addition, to methods, functions associated with this kind of object. We've said last on Monday that an object, so to speak, a chunk of memory, can have not just methods associated with it, but also pieces of data, aka properties. So it turns out that inside of this object, once you're using it to send requests and get back responses unbeknownst to the user, you can check things like, what is the state of this object? In other words, is it ready for a request? Is it already receiving a request? So there's a flag you can check for that. But more interesting, perhaps, is the status one, because we've seen this before. Because this thing's purpose in life is to go out onto the internet, get some data, and return the response from a web server, it'd kind of be nice if you programmatically could check, well, did a response come back? Or was the page not found? Or is it forbidden because the permissions are off? In other words, it'd be nice if you didn't have to rely on the user to sort of send an email to the help desk saying the website's not working because of some stupid permissions problem. Rather, you yourself can check using some JavaScript functions if, in fact, the request came back okay. Did the tile from Google come back okay? So that these properties make that possible. So let's take a look at this code in action. So here is a very simple form, and this is meant to mimic what's going on in problem set 7. I've clearly made an XHTML form. I've specified a text field that I'm going to put a symbol in. I'm going to go ahead now and get a quote. And this is relatively easy to do in problem set 7. In fact, we pretty much hold your hands during that first module of the project. But notice that I wanted to be a little fancier. I didn't care so much about aesthetics, but I don't like the idea of having you refresh the whole page because it doesn't lend itself to a nice seamless experience. Better if I can keep interacting with the same page a la Gmail and just have part of the page change. So I'm going to go ahead and look up, let's say, Yahoo stock quote. I'm going to click get quote. And notice it comes back, albeit in the form of an annoying alert box, but the whole page has not refreshed. Let me go ahead and try this again. So let me go ahead and search for Goog, get quote, and I get back another $284.66. If I rely on my favorite little plugin here, live HTTP headers, let's put that off to the side for a moment, shrink this window so we can see both at once, just to see what happens. So the plugin is right here. I'm going to go ahead and click get quote again for Goog, and notice what just happened. An HTTP request did, in fact, go across the wire. What was it? Well, it looks like it was this request. So to zoom in on that, what's just happened is Firefox, or whatever browser I happen to be using, requested a file called quote1.php that's in the AJAX directory, in the source directory, in lecture 9, in weeks, in lectures, right? The whole long path that we use on the course's web server. But the interesting part is that just like last week, I'm passing in HTTP parameters. So after the question mark comes symbol equals Goog. And that's all that's going on behind the scenes here. Now, what's coming back from the web server? Well, an HTTP response, there's not all that much to it here. It's just saying 200. That means something good actually happened. But what's happening programmatically is this, behind the scenes. So here is that same web page, ajax1.html. Notice that all I've got XHTML-wise is body. I've got a form element, and then notice this, one of these event handlers, which is where really the magic starts to happen when you're writing interactive web pages. On the submission of this form, I don't want it to actually get submitted to the web server. Notice I'm outright saying return false. Don't let this form get submitted truly. Rather, go ahead and invoke a function that apparently I wrote called quote. And now it's worth noting, here's the text symbol. The input type I'm using is indeed of type text. But notice I've given this input a unique ID. It's kind of like naming a variable, but IDs can be defined as unique, which just means it's much easier or more reliable to find them in a really big web page. And then I've got some typical submit button. So what's this quote function? All right, well, let's see. It's not all that long because it's leveraging this existing AJAX API. So up here we have function quote, and to be clear, this is just inside of my head tag, inside of a script tag. So I apparently have a global variable called XHR, XML HTTP request is the convention there. Here's my quote function. What is it going to do? So there's this syntax that some of you might have seen before in Java and other languages where you can try to do something in hopes that it won't fail. But if it does fail, you can quote unquote catch the error. So this is an example of a language that supports what are called exceptions. C is relatively annoying, at least in comparison to more modern languages, because it doesn't have this error handling mechanism. Consider, after all, the nuisance of writing so many damn error checks in some of your programs. Like even our copy.c program, for the forensics problem set. When I wrote the distribution code for that program, I had to check almost every function's return value. Is this an error? Is this an error? Is this an error? And it certainly takes the fun out of programming. And it also makes the code less readable if everything is surrounded with an if condition checking, did this work? Did this work? Did this work? Right? So you might have felt that yourselves when certainly being pushed by your TFs to do more error checking. Well, one of the things that exceptions allow you to do is to try to do the following lines of code, and if any one of them fails, catch the error somehow, and then deal with it. So you can actually sandwich inside of a try block a whole bunch of lines of code, and then determine later what error actually happened. And it's actually a wonderful programmatic technique that more modern languages do have, like JavaScript and Java, because it allows you to focus, I think, more on the logic of your program and then handle the error checking separately. And you don't have to use return values all over the place to check for errors. So know that this is coming in other languages that you might learn. Now, in this case, I'm just doing it because it's necessary so as to detect errors with something fairly simple. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to, quote unquote, instantiate a new object. So in JavaScript, there's this keyword called new, which, as the word implies, says, give me a new one of these. This is sort of the new and improved version of the idea of malloc. Right? So you're not allocating raw memory. You're allocating a specific type of object sort of all at once, which is nice. But otherwise, if that errors and you have to catch an error, go ahead and try this instead. So this is actually a bit of abuse of this notion of try-catch. So don't walk away thinking this is how it's always done. But this is one of these headaches that has arisen because of competition in the market. So Microsoft, liking always to be different, decided to call their version of this thing something completely different. It supports the same properties for the most part, but it's different. So the same, but different. And across different versions of browsers have these kinds of things changed. So all I'm doing here effectively is saying, try to instantiate one of these for many of the popular browsers, Firefox, I think Chrome, and so forth. But if that doesn't work, let's assume that it's a Microsoft browser, IE, and try to instantiate one of these things instead. OK, now at this point, I check both of them. If this thing is still null, this must mean the user's using like Netscape 1.0 to visit my website before any of this stuff existed. So forget about it. Let's just alert the user, return, and not even try to proceed. But if it's not null, and I actually do now have an object in memory that's that lends itself to AJAX, an XML HTTP request, go ahead and do this. So here's a variable called URL. So it's apparently a string. JavaScript, like PHP, doesn't really have strong data typing. You don't have to worry about what the variable's type is. So create a string called quote1.php, question mark, symbol, equals, and then what is nice in PHP, in JavaScript, and a lot of languages is string concatenation. It's so much easier. How do you concatenate two strings in C? Strcat is one way. You can use a for loop and copy characters from two buffers into one bigger buffer, but that's sort of the key nuisance. You have to deal with the memory. You have to make sure you have enough memory for the length of both strings in order to concatenate them together, and you have to jump through hoops just to do something so darn simple. Well, in PHP, you can use the dot operator to concatenate two strings together, and you might see this in some of the section notes. In JavaScript, same idea, but it's the plus symbol. Same in Java if you came from that world. So this is saying concatenate this string together with what string? Well, document.getElementById is a free, a built-in function in JavaScript that you can access any element by way of its unique ID. And because I had the foresight to define an element with the unique ID of symbol, what I'm able to do is go in there, grab that element, and then dive in, just like we did Monday, to get its value. So this is taking whatever was typed into this form, in this case G-O-O-G, and it's appending it to this string that began with quote 1.php question mark symbol equals. So that's it. All I did was construct a string. Really, I constructed this thing. The thing that I'm trying to send to the browser, I just constructed sort of dynamically by using this set of concatenation. All right, so why is this useful? Well, the last thing I do in order for any magic to happen is I get the quote by way of three lines of code. One, I first say to this XML HTTP request object, call the following function when the web server responds. So the other idea that we're able to introduce in this context of web pages and JavaScript is actually this wonderfully useful idea from computer science where you can have callback functions. You can have asynchronicity. And by that I mean this. In the world of C, thus as we've used it, when you call a function, you pretty much sit there and wait, twiddling your thumbs until that function returns. So if that function's really damn slow, like it was for some of you in your first versions of your dictionary, your code takes a long time to run, and you don't move to the next line of code until that function has returned. Now, this is kind of annoying in, say, the context of a web page, because if I'm implementing Gmail, and I've just done something like spell check my document or do something, save this document, even if, yeah, the network is slow and it might take 5 seconds for whatever I want to do to happen, I'd kind of like to go off and do something else on this page. So similarly, if you're using Microsoft Word, it's kind of nice if you can say, print this document, even if it's a 100-page thesis, but let me keep working. Let the printer deal with it from then. So we talked in week zero about this idea of threading, having multiple threads. Well, now we get that same idea back. In JavaScript, you can have asynchronicity in that a function can get called, it will return right away, but you can tell whatever function, you can tell your operating environment, call this other function as soon as you're done. So you break up your code into the first half and the second half, where the first half does the calling and the second half does the fielding of the response. So what we're saying here is this. There is a property called onReadyStateChange associated with this sort of global standard, this XML HTTP request object, and I'm saying assign that equal to handler. Well, notice handler is apparently a function, so you can actually do this in C. In C, you can pass functions around by way of what are called function pointers. And we didn't do this in any of the problem sets, but a function has an address in memory, an address in a text segment in the program's layout and RAM. So you can pass around a function's address just like a variable's address, and that's pretty much what's happening here. I am saying, effectively, call whatever function is pointed at by this variable when you are ready to change your state, so to speak, when the web server responds. Well, what is it you want to do? Well, I want to open up an HTTP request using the get method to this URL, and true here says make it asynchronous. In other words, return right away, but then call this other function and when I'm ready for you. So that's a useful trick. And then we send the response, just sending null because we have nothing else to say. So now think about this is what happens literally when I click get quote. That's the point in the story we're at, before the pop-up comes up. How does the pop-up get there? Well, the moment the web server responds, even if it takes a while, this handler function gets invoked. And notice the first thing I do is I just check, is this global object's ready state property equal to 4? Well, where did that come from? Well, 4 apparently means that the page was loaded, right? So that is the page came back, the data came back okay. So if it equals 4 and the whole request status is 200, which means good stuff happened, that is like the best thing to happen, go ahead and pop up an alert that says whatever the response text is. So when you get back a response, notice that I did mention it in this bulleted list. Not only do you have properties like onReadyStateChange, ReadyState, you also have responseText and responseXML, which essentially are variables inside this object that contain whatever it is that the web server responded with. So all I'm doing is alerting the user by way of this JavaScript pop-up to whatever the value is of the text that came back from the server. So what came back from the server? Where did we submit this thing to in the first place? Well, remember, there was some quote1.php file involved. So if I look at quote1.php, there's not all that much code going on here. And it looks cryptic only because there's an ugly URL. What I did was I went through problem set 7, and I ripped out a couple lines of code relevant to stock quote fetching, and notice that I'm calling fopen. Turns out wonderfully useful in PHP. Not only can you open files with fopen, you can open URLs and start reading from them as though they were local to you, which is wonderfully useful. So I'm first checking, does the handle that I've opened equal false, or not equal false? Because if it does, then that means some error happened. Yahoo is down, or the URL is wrong, and so forth. But if it wasn't equal to false, I want to go ahead and do this. So there's the function apparently called fgetCSV. What is CSV? Comma separated variables. If any of you have ever had we can do this real quick in Excel. This is a very popular, if trivial, format in which to save data. If I go ahead and load up Notepad, suppose that I needed to make a quick and dirty database, I could sort of take the very simple approach of saying David is in Mather and his ID number is 12345. And Jansu is in Elliot and her number is 67890. And so forth. I can essentially have the notion of three columns, whereby I separate columns with commas. It's a very trivial sort of database definition. And I'm going to save this by convention as database.csv. And I've saved that now onto my desktop. But notice, turns out Microsoft Excel, which many of you have probably used, treat CSV files as though they were spreadsheets. So if I open this file that I made with Notepad, now everything lines up nicely in columns. So in fact, what Yahoo is doing is distributing their quote data, not in some proprietary Excel format, but in this very trivial CSV format. So what I'm really getting back when I do a stock quote, and when you guys do a stock quote for problem set 7, is this. Let me copy this URL. Let me go ahead to, say, a browser. I'm going to go ahead and now manually get the quote for MSFT, for Microsoft, and hit enter. Notice that it tries to open a file called quotes.csv. I'm not going to open it directly. Let me go ahead and save it, just to prove that what I'm getting back is a file. So this is what I've gotten back. I'll open this in Word, and now notice that, missing format variable. So I did something wrong. So let me go back here, and aha, there's an ampersand after this. So remember from our discussion in problem set 7, Yahoo supports a whole bunch of sort of unofficial format strings that tells the thing what to return. So let me go ahead and get rid of this, because I did mess up. Delete this file. Let's go back to my browser, append this after the symbol. So ampersand separates our variables. And the one I wanted was ampersand F for format equals this string. So I'm going to go ahead and paste this in, enter. I'm going to get back same named file, quotes.csv, but hopefully it's different. Let's save that locally. Here it is. And voila. What I've gotten back is NA, which who knows what that means in this case. I don't even remember the format string, but I do remember that the second column in this string denotes the current stock price. So in effect, what Yahoo's doing, what Yahoo Finance is doing that we are taking advantage of, if sort of unofficially, is this ability to download stock quotes. And the reason we knew this existed was when last year I sat down to sort of invent this problem set, I thought it'd be neat if we could let students integrate stock quotes into a problem set. So I pulled up literally this page, which apparently is using what technology? Technology, right? Ajax, right? Because the page is kind of updating itself in the middle without redrawing the whole page. So Microsoft, or Yahoo in this case, is using the same technology. And it just caught my eye a year ago that there's this link to download data. And I noticed that in the URL field down here, what happened was I was going to get some CSV file, quotes.csv, and so it occurred to me, well, this is it. Even though this is meant to be used by humans, clicking this link and getting a file in CSV format from Yahoo's site, which by default actually has more fields, as you can see here, well, it occurred to me, you know, PHP comes with the kitchen sink, the ability to do most anything, like pretend to be a browser. So it's thanks to this function, fopen, that I can effectively pretend to be a browser, grab a URL, get back a file in CSV format, and again, because PHP pretty much comes with everything built in, turns out there's a function called fgetCSV. And what this function does is it gets, as an array, all of the values that are separated by commas in a CSV file, which is perfect because what I want is the data that's in the first column, column number 1, not 0, but 1, 1 over. And so the means by which I am getting the stock data is just by accessing that element in the array, and then that's it. So what quote1.php is doing is very simply this. This is all it takes to implement a very simple version of an Ajax experience. Notice that quote1.php takes a symbol. So let me actually manually make this happen. Let me go back to my little sample code here and go not to ajax1.html, but quote1.php. I'm just going to hit enter. Nothing seems to be happening because, again, I need symbol. So let's see. Question mark. Symbol equals MSFT enter. So all I've done is I implemented the simplest of PHP programs called quote1.php. It doesn't even return XHTML. It doesn't return anything fancy. All it does, apparently, is print a piece of text to the screen because I'm accessing it in a browser. But in the context of Ajax1.html, which is a program that's pulling up this same data, what it's doing is it's getting it back in the form of this XML HTTP object. It's storing it in a variable called response text. So if I want to show that text to the user, I just have to take that variable and display it, as with the alert function. And it's from these very simple building blocks, frankly, that you get some of today's most sophisticated interfaces. It all boils down to that sort of basic. You execute a function, wait for it to return. When it does return, update the page. Repeat. Let's take a 2-minute break. All right, we are back. So where we left off was that simple Ajax example whereby we used a JavaScript pop-up to print out the stock price. Kind of sucks, right? No one wants JavaScript pop-ups telling them what stock prices are. More elegant would be, just like Yahoo's own site, is to integrate that response into the web page. So here's version 2. Ajax2.html has a text field like before for the symbol, and then I just kind of left a placeholder in boldface that says to be determined. So my goal now with this code is to embed into the web page and replace that bold-faced text outright with whatever quote came back from the server side. So let's take a look at how this is now done. So I'm going to go ahead and open ajax2.html. I'm going to go ahead again and type in, let's say, MSFT and click get quote. And now we have a more seamless interface. It's not the fanciest page, certainly. It's still pretty trivial, but at least we have sort of the building block with which something like the actual Yahoo Finance is made. So let's see how this works. So it looks like down here, the XHTML is almost the same as before, but I've done at least one thing different. Not only do I have a symbol field with an ID of symbol, notice that two lines below that, I now have a span element. So this is just something that exists in XHTML. That's similar in spirit to the div element. So we talked briefly about this. You might have played with this already. A div element says, here comes a division of the page. Some stuff's going to go in here. But by nature of divs, if you embed a div in an XHTML page, it gives you an automatic line break. So anything that comes after the div's close tag ends up on a new line. That's kind of annoying because I wanted this to be determined string to end up on the same line. So you can use a span. Same idea. Here comes sort of a spanning of the page, but it's inline. So it's not a block element. It's an inline element, so to speak. All this means for me is that I can put a sort of placeholder in the page. So the fact that I have open span and close span, and yes, some default text inside of it, but because I've given this span an ID, that means I have programmatic access now to this element very easily by way of getElementById, that function we've used a few times now. And thanks to that function, can I dive into this element and actually replace what's there? So let's take a look. So if I scroll up now and I look at my quote function, the top of it is still the same. Create the object, try this other way for Microsoft, make sure that it's not null, construct the URL, and down here, it's the same. The quote function is identical, despite the marginal enhancement here. So let's look at the handler function. So handler function, almost identical, except for this one line of code. So it turns out that just as form fields, like a text field, has a dot value property, well, any XHTML element also has a dot inner HTML element, which conceptually refers to any XHTML, any HTML that's embedded in between the open tag and the close tag. So if you want to change something that's here in the middle, like the string to be determined, what we have to change is that span's inner HTML to the result of what came back from the server. So whereas before, this function was implemented with in Ajax 1 with alert passing in xhr.response text, this version just sets the contents of the price element inner HTML to be that same string. So that's the only line of code it took to change that rather kludgy interface with the pop-up to something that integrates the content into the actual page. So this is much more akin to what Google's doing. This is much more akin to what Facebook is doing to integrate more and more photos into the page. So what more can we do from here? Well, let's take a look at this third example. Please, this example, Ajax 3. .html. I decided, you know what, this isn't the best interface because if the web server's kind of slow, as can happen, if the internet's slow, if you're on dial-up or just a slow broadband connection, you know, it'd kind of be nice to indicate to the user that something is happening, right? This is why browsers have little stupid icons that spin around or globes that spin to indicate progress or the fact that the browser's doing something. A downside with AJAX, if poorly implemented, is that you might click submit and nothing seems to be happening unless you're actually so technical as to sniff your own traffic and watch it go by. Nothing seems to be happening, so it would at least be nice to pretend to the user that something's happening. So, you know, I went out on the internet and I said something like AJAX progress bars, and I went to, well, let's see, the first hit here. Let's see, that's not what I want. I want something animated. Let's see if I can get something really tacky. Probably not the professionally looking one, is it? All right, so I wanted something like this. This is what I'm talking about. So we've talked about graphics earlier in the course. We talked about BMPs a lot, kind of sort of JPEGs. GIF is another very popular one. And one of the features of the GIF, GIF format, is that you can have animations. And it's a little mini slideshow. A GIF is just a rectangular image that's got a whole bunch of frames that you can program using Photoshop or other programs to just rotate at one per second or one every 100 milliseconds, something like that. And the effect, like comic book style, is the illusion of animation, which is really any movie or animation is. So I found one of those images. I downloaded it, and now I integrate it into this version, AJAX 3, so that when I get quote, notice that I get this. I didn't work very hard to get something pretty, but I just needed an animated graphic, and then eventually does the response come back. So let's see. Goog. Let's try Goog. Get quote. Seems the internet's all of a sudden pretty slow. Why is this happening? And there we go. Now it updated itself. Well, how was this working? Well, it turns out I just needed to fake this. And it turns out if you just call sleep for 5 seconds, it creates the illusion of a slow internet connection. But that's all I wanted to demonstrate here. The idea is the same. All of the AJAX stuff is the same. Granted, I used a slightly different format string to Yahoo this time because I wanted to get not only the current price, albeit 15 minutes delayed, but I wanted to get the day's high and the day's low. So notice, because this thing is an array that I'm getting back, I go into data bracket 1 to get the column number 1 in Excel, the B column, data bracket 2, data bracket 3 to get to the next one. So all these ideas are kind of nicely converging. A few pieces of syntactic details I should point out. This you might think is a typo. It's actually intentional. So you've seen the equal operator, the assignment operator. You've seen the equal-equal operator, which is the equality operator. Now there's actually an equals-equals-equals operator called the identical operator. So because PHP doesn't have strong data typing, the world decided it would be nice if there's a way that you can check, technically, are two values the same, but are they also of the same type? And so if you want to check that some variable is not only equal to some value but identical to it, you say equals equals equals, or bang equals equals for the opposite of that. Now, what does this mean? Well, you remember from C perhaps that false is the same thing as zero, which is the same thing as 0.0, which is the same thing as null, right? They all kind of evaluate to the same value implicitly. Well, in PHP, if you actually want to distinguish 0.0, a float, from zero, an int, from null, a string, from false, a boolean, well, you can use equals, equals, equals. And thankfully, the sequence ends there. There is no equals, 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 at least in no language I know of. So we're using this in two places here, but there's another piece of syntactic sugar, so to speak. If I were to do this here, bad things can happen. So notice that I've embedded into this call to print, quote unquote, price, colon, and then this variable here. So, and then I've gotten rid of these curly braces. Let's see what happens here. Let's do Yahoo this time. Get quote. See what happens. Is that right? No, that's right, actually. I've got to stop doing demos on the fly that I haven't pre-canned. All right. That's okay. Quotes are better. For reasons that I didn't use a different data structure. I think if I actually had a data structure that used the arrow operator, which we won't bother going into in PHP, then these curly braces are necessary. So we'll delete the past 30 seconds from the tape. How about? All right. So any questions on AJAX and what you can do with this stuff? All right. So now let's do something more interesting, not so much because I made it, but because it leverages some really neat features that someone else made. So one of the things you'll be doing for a problem set 8 is using Google Maps API. And again, an API is an application programming interface. And this is not something unique to Google. Now that you sort of have programming chops and you go off to solve some problem for fun in your dorm room, for a job, for some other class, for research, odds are you won't be implementing everything yourself from the ground up. In fact, most of the code you write after this course, if you use it for sort of real world purposes, for most real-world purposes, you probably won't use C so often. It'll be one of the tools in your proverbial toolkit, but you'll only whip out C or C++ most likely if you really need something high-performing and something that's really fast. Because usually, thanks to the ridiculously fast computers we have on our desks these days, it's a lot faster to write code in something like PHP or Python or Ruby or a higher-level language that's interpreted. And thus, you do pay a performance penalty. It might be 4 or 5 times as slow. But if you've got a 2 gigahertz processor, a 4 gigahertz processor in multiple cores, might not be such an issue. And so one of the exercises, one of the goals in problem set 8.2 will be for you to take a fairly large data file in like CSV format that we'll give you, and you're going to have to figure out how to get a really big file, way too big for you to copy-paste into PHP MyAdmin. It's going to be up to you to figure out how to get this big data set into an actual database so you can execute SQL queries against it. And the motivation there is that one of the most common things I do, frankly, is these days programming-wise, is not sit down and write, you know, spell checkers and not sit down and write my own stock trading programs. I write quick and dirty scripts to save myself time because I've got a big data set. I'm certainly not going to copy and paste everything to change things around. I just want to do something quickly and en masse. And I do this a whole bunch for this course. We get, for instance, the registrar's data for this course in CSV format. And it would be a pain in the neck to copy-paste 332 rows into our own database for the course. So what I do at the start of the semester is I write a quick and dirty script that uses PHP, that uses fgetcsv. I grab the registrar's data and I massage it into our own formats. I put it into our own database using these very skills that we've been looking at this week. And so that's going to be one of the takeaways, too, is that one of the biggest design decisions involved in programming, frankly, is the very first. What language do you use? And so this is what we're trying to empower you with in this course. So if you go to this website here, Google Maps API, this is where not the users go to use Google Maps, this is where the developers go, the programmers, who actually want to integrate Google Maps into their own site. So if I go ahead and go to, say, the Google Maps API, let's see, they have a gallery somewhere, maybe. Google Maps for Enterprise, let's see, concepts. Somewhere, oh, demos, here we go. So there's some really neat demos that you can play around with if you've never seen this, but their very common mashups are to take like Craigslist data, take a Google map, as I said Monday, smash them together, and what you get then are little icons representing all of the apartments available in Cambridge or Boston or Manhattan or elsewhere. And what this gallery is a whole bunch of other examples as well. But in short, what it takes to use a Google map in your own website is you sign up for a Google account for free. They give you a unique identifier, a developer's key that you embed into your website so they can keep track of where their code's being used. There's no charge to you. And then what you do is you go ahead and start embedding that code along with some basics into your own website. So one of the things you'll be drawing on for problem set 8 is the Maps API reference. And one of our goals in introducing JavaScript, if briefly this week, was to make sure that when you pull up a page like this, you're not completely overwhelmed. There is way more functionality, way more features in Google's API than you will use, and way more than even I'm familiar with. But by way of examples, by way of looking at things of interest to me, you kind of figure out from the documentation, JavaScript's version of like a man page or the PHP manual, you figure out what you need, right? Control F is your friend. If you want to find some feature or figure out how some argument works, you sort of figure it out. So RTFM is kind of one of these overarching themes in programming, certainly when the stuff is new to you. So let's take a look, for instance, at Shuttleboy, only because it's a very simple implementation or deployment of Google's own API. So here's the Google Maps one. Funny thing, it's been in beta for like 2 years now. I just never finished it, right? There's a better map might actually have lines that represent routes. And this is not hard to do. If you know the GPS coordinates of the roads and whatnot here, you can tell Google's API, you know, draw a purple line here, draw a green line here. I just frankly didn't want to sit there one night and figure out all of the coordinates. So it's been on my to-do list for a while, as now is to move the dots into Cambridge. But let's take a look at the source code. So I have gone into my FAS account, And this is the JavaScript code that this page uses. So if I go ahead and pull up the source code, view page source, which most anyone can do, I got some CSS in here, I've got some XHTML, I've got some Yahoo library stuff because I figured it's easier to use someone else's code sometimes that they make available, and then I'm including this thing. So as we've said with CSS and JavaScript, I wrote a file called google.js that just has my Google-specific JavaScript code that I wrote. And again, this example was the very first time I'd used Google Maps. I decided it would be fun to figure out how to do this, so I pulled up the same web pages I just showed you guys, started playing around, took me a couple hours to get it right, and then, even then, not right, but it wasn't that hard. So what did I do? Well, one of the first things I had to do was just some busy work. I needed to figure out the GPS coordinates of the shuttle stops on the official shuttle map that some of you carry around. That was just a pain, if nothing else. That was just grunt work. Can't really automate some of that. All right, so what did I do with it? Well, I apparently declared an array called points, and then I plopped into that array, using the trick I mentioned Monday, all of these GPS coordinates in y, x format. So g lat lang, and the fact that it says new here, this hints at the instantiation of an object. So it turns out Google has an object called g lat long, which somehow encapsulates, as objects are meant to do, pieces of data. And two pieces of data that are encapsulated by this object are apparently a GPS latitude and longitudinal coordinates. Now, if you start to get curious about this stuff, that's when, again, when I said a moment ago, the Google Maps API's documentation becomes quite useful. Because if I go back to the API's map reference, and again, it's a little overwhelming at first, but wait, there it is, glatlong. Let's see, this is a class. So a class is similar in spirit to an object. If you take CS51, these ideas that we're spewing out this week and last will become much more familiar since the course focuses on this kind of stuff. But this is a point in a geographical coordinate, coordinates, longitude and latitude, and then apparently it's got a constructor, which is just means a function that gets called when you create the object using the new operator. Then here are the methods. So apparently if I call the object.lat, I'm going to get back a number that represents this object's latitude coordinates. If I call .lang, LNG, I get the longitudinal coordinates. If I call this thing with radians, equals, there's a whole bunch of functions, methods, that do useful things with coordinates. Well, let's see what I did. I apparently first just declared this array of a whole bunch of coordinates, and then what did I do? All right, I've got some fanciness with some other arrays, but let's focus on this. So initialize. So notice that the one line of code that it took to actually embed this thing into my website was this right, this page looks more overwhelming than it needs to, this. So I learned this from Google's documentation. Here's my body tag. The means by which you use a Google map in your page, apparently, is say onload, call this function, and on unload, call this other function. That's one way to do it. What are those functions? Well, those are the two things I wrote. So here's my initialize function. First, I do a sanity check, because I was told to by the documentation. Is the browser G browser compatible? If not, we'll just quit, because this thing's not going to work for this user. Too old. Now I check, is there an element in the page whose ID is map? Well, if not, forget it. There's no placeholder for the map. So that's all a Google map is. I have a div element in my page that has an ID, and I'm just telling Google, go plop your map into the element on my page with this ID. Now I do some stuff to instantiate the map. Again, stuff that the documentation will walk you through. I call this function map.center to center the map on campus. Then I add some controls. So you'll notice that I've got this stuff up here and these things up here. If I go ahead and delete those temporarily and reload my page, well, now those things are gone. So adding those kinds of controls is very easy, thanks to this API. And now I'm doing this. So for I in points, this is a for loop using a fancy syntactic trick to just iterate over all of the elements of those points. I'm apparently creating a new icon here. I'm using this image, which is a blue circle marker that I downloaded from Google. I'm specifying that this icon should be 10 pixels by 10 pixels. Where do I want to put this? At some relative coordinate, 0, 0. I don't want any fancy shadow. Now I'm doing something that apparently is creating an object, but I'm glossing over some of these details because the documentation will explain or at least give you what you need to know. But all it takes to add these dots to the screen, apparently, is to call add overlay, passing in this marker I've created. Now, if I reload without that line, notice all of the stops go away. So we're having a very real effect here. And then I'm calling update. And again, the point of this exercise, and I'll stop short here, is not to teach you how Shuttle Boy works, because who really cares how this particular site works, but it's an example, and the source code is freely available because it is JavaScript and the XHTML is there. It's representative of exactly what you'll be doing in problem set 7, and problem set 8, and it's using Ajax thanks to, and I'll show you this one line of code, it's using this function here that I mentioned on Monday, the mere call of set timeout. This function you get for free in a web page specifying a specific period, which apparently is 2 seconds, and calling a function called update is what creates that sort of animated effect by calling the same function again and again. So I wanted us to save time for this finale here. So this, yes, get excited. Here, to conclude our week on all things internet and PHP and such related, is a true fake look at how the internet works. So I hope you enjoy this. It's a few minutes long.
For the first time in history, people and machinery are working together, realizing a dream. A uniting force that knows no geographical boundaries without regard to race, creed, or color. A new era where communication truly brings people together. This is the dawn of the net. Want to know how it works? Click here to begin your journey into the net. Now, exactly what happened when you clicked on that link? You started a flow of information. This information travels down into your own personal mailroom, where Mr. IP packages it, labels it, and sends it on its way. Each packet is limited in its size. The mailroom must decide how to divide the information and how to package it. Now, the package needs a label containing important information, such as sender's address, receiver's address, and the type of packet it is. Because this particular packet is going out onto the internet, it also gets an address for the proxy server, which has a special function, as we'll see later. The packet is now launched onto your local area network, or LAN. This network is used to connect all the local computers, routers, printers, etc. for information exchange within the physical walls of the building. The LAN is a pretty uncontrolled place and, unfortunately, accidents can happen. The highway of the LAN is packed with all types of information. These are IP packets, Novell packets, Apple Talk packets. They're going against traffic, as usual. The local router reads the address and, if necessary, lifts the packet onto another network. The router, a symbol of control in a seemingly disorganized world.
Sorry about that.
There he is, systematic, uncaring, methodical, conservative, and sometimes not quite up to speed. But at least he is exact, for the most part.
was there, and this one was there. Well, another one that was there, and it was there. He bought him, he was there, and he was there, and he was there. He was there, and he was there.
As the packets leave the router, they make their way into the corporate intranet and head for the router switch. A bit more efficient than the router switch plays fast and loose with IP packets, deftly routing them along their way. A digital pinball wizard, if you will.
Here we go. Here comes another one. And it's another. Watch this, Mom. Here goes the whoop around the back. Hey, in there, in there, in there. Over the left, over the right, over the left, over the right. You got it. Here it comes. Right out. He shoots. He scores. It's going. Hey, wait. Here, watch out. Here comes another one. Oh, here we go. And it's
As packets arrive at their destination, they're picked up by the network interface, ready to be sent to the next level. In this case, the proxy. The proxy is used by many companies as sort of a middleman in order to lessen the load on their internet connection, and for security reasons as well. As you can see, the packets are all of various sizes, depending upon their content. The proxy opens the packet and looks for the web address or URL. Depending upon whether the address is acceptable, the packet is sent on to the internet. There are, however, some addresses which do not meet with the approval of the proxy, that is to say, corporate or management guidelines. These are summarily dealt with. We'll have none of that. For those who make it, it's on the road again. Next up, the firewall. The corporate firewall serves two purposes. It prevents some rather nasty things from the internet from coming into the intranet, and it can also prevent sensitive corporate information from being sent out onto the internet. Once through the firewall, a router picks up the packet and places it onto a much narrower road, or bandwidth, as we say. Obviously, the road is not broad enough to take them all. Now you might wonder what happens to all those packets which don't make it along the way. Well, when Mr. IP doesn't receive an acknowledgement that a packet has been received in due time, he simply sends a replacement packet. We are now ready to enter the world of the internet. A spider web of interconnected networks which span our entire globe. Here, routers and switches establish links between networks. Now, the net is an entirely different environment than you'll find within the protected walls of your LAN. Out here, it's the Wild West. Plenty of space, plenty of opportunities, plenty of things to explore and places to go. Thanks to very little control and regulation, new ideas find fertile soil to push the envelope of their possibilities. But because of this freedom, certain dangers also lurk. You'll never know when you'll meet the dreaded ping of death. A special version of a normal request ping, which some idiot thought up to mess up unsuspecting hosts. The paths our packets take may be via satellite, telephone lines, wireless, or even transoceanic cable. They don't always take the fastest or shortest routes possible, but they will get there. Eventually. Maybe that's why sometimes...
Exciting conclusion. Go to warriorsofthe.net. We'll see you Monday.
Working smoothly, you can circumvent the globe five times over at the drop of a hat.